All Along the Watchtower from Bob Dylan as we start the birthday celebrations for the 80-year-old Bob Dylan. And our first guest this evening, Sean Latham, the director of the Institute of Bob Dylan Studies in the University of Tulsa and the editor of the recently published The World of Bob Dylan, a series of essays looking at the various Bob Dylans that we have gotten throughout Dylan's life and career. Sean, we start there with All Along the Watchtower, and in some ways that song gives us so many different Dylans. It's probably the song that he has revisited and reimagined more times than any other, is it?
It's certainly up there among the ones that he likes to play in concert and reinvent. And of course, the song itself was most famously reinvented by Jimi Hendrix, who found something entirely different in those lyrics that I think surprised anybody that had maybe heard Dylan first perform them. And it's now become, you know, one of the greatest rock songs ever written, thanks in part to Hendrix.
It didn't start life as a rock song back on the 1967 album John Wesley Harding. Which Bob Dylan were we getting at that time?
I mean, this is the Bob Dylan that makes John Wesley Harding, that's just emerged from seclusion in Woodstock for a couple of years. He's been making sort of country down-home music with his friends from the band who toured with him in 66. They'd sort of set aside the electric instruments for a while and were just jamming in this big pink house in Woodstock and exploring all kinds of traditional folk music from American and other traditions. And it's from that well of musical experimentation that this song comes. And I think it's important to note also from Dylan's deep reading of the Bible during this period, which was an equally formative influence, which is why you get this almost parable-like song here that seems to be about something that we can't quite put our finger on.
Which is kind of a touchstone for Dylan himself. You say it in the introduction to the book I mentioned that you edited, The World of Bob Dylan. You talk about how almost untouchable, how unfathomable he is, how we can't actually get at who he is. It's very difficult to do that. To what extent is it difficult because Dylan himself loves this process of myth-making?
I think he loves the process of myth-making because it gives him a chance to go inhabit all of the different selves that sort of constitute, I think, what for him is an American set of identities, that there's no one right way to inhabit what it means to be an American. And Dylan loves to explore all of the traditions that go into that musically, ideologically, politically, socially. So that's why we can get the sort of happy rocker from or the happy folk singer, rather, from the early 60s. We can get the politically engaged activist from the mid-60s, the rocker from 1966, the country performer, the crooner. Right? He manages the gospel singer. I mean, he covers nearly every genre of American music. And I don't think there's really a Dylan to get to, because Dylan himself is saying these are all different pieces of me and of what it means to be an American popular music performer.
But I guess to some extent for most people, if I'm not speaking for the entire Bob Dylan listeners, this evening, I think that you know, the activist period, the songs of protest, that's probably where most people, if you said Bob Dylan to the average man on the street, I think that's probably what they would think of. Is that fair to say?
I think that's absolutely true. And, you know, Dylan's always hated being called the voice of a generation, but that doesn't change the fact that things like Blowin' in the Wind became civil rights anthems, and that music itself was played just a couple years ago by Regina Spektor at the Women's March on Washington here. Those activist songs will live with us forever, I think.
Blind Willie McTell from 1983, we're really into his love of the blues, but how does Dylan approach the blues, and what influences does he bring in there, even exploring his right to sing the blues in some ways, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think that's what makes this song such an absolute masterpiece, is when you go and listen to Dylan's very first album, it's filled with covers. Like many young people that had come to Greenwich Village at that time as part of the folk movement, they were covering blues performers from the early part of the 20th century, almost all black and almost all singing about experiences that were pretty far from those of a middle-class kid from Hibbing, Minnesota. And Dylan sings in particular a haunting version, because he's a great mimic, actually, of Blind Lemon Jefferson's See That My Grave Is Kept Clean, which is really about the aftermath of a lynching. And Dylan does an amazing performance of it, but I think by the time he gets to the 80s and he gets to Blind Willie McTell, this is a guy that's looking back and saying, I'm not sure I can sing those songs. I'm not sure what right I have to sing the blues, because I can't ever quite understand those experiences that I could mimic but never really fully inhabit or understand.
Them charcoal gypsy maidens can strut their feathers well, but nobody sing the blues.
Brian Willie McTell from Bob Dylan as we celebrate his 80th birthday on this Monday evening. And with me at the beginning of the programme tonight is Sean Latham, who is the director of the Institute of Bob Dylan Studies at the University of Tulsa and the editor of the book, The World of Bob Dylan. There's not really, as you say, he seems to have, by the time we get that version of Blind Willie McTell, has he stopped that imitation? Is he trying to find a more authentic way for him to sing a song like that, Sean?
Well, I don't even know if authenticity is quite the word I would use there. I think what we hear him is doing is wrestling with the fact that we can't get away from history, but we still need it to imagine a kind of human future. So Dylan, this is a brilliant blues song. It's powerful. It's moving. I mean, it gets me every time I hear it. I think it's Dylan's maybe greatest composition. But what he's basically saying here is no matter how good a blues man I might be, no matter how well I can perform, no one can sing the blues like Blind Willie McTell, right? The blind black performer from the 20s who helped invent this form. I live in this music. It's got a racist history that we can't escape. Mm. And it's always going to be a part of my performance. But that doesn't mean I can't sing it. It just means I have to live with that hard history.
One of the essays in the book, it goes into this whole idea of, many of them touch on the idea that several myths around Bob Dylan. Is there a suggestion by perhaps along the way that even the Newport Festival and the Going Electric, there's something mythical in that tale as well?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Dylan's a man of many myths, and it's because he's a big star. And because, you know, I think one thing that really stands out about Dylan, as I said earlier, is this constant reinvention. That it's not just Newport where he gets booed. He gets booed in 1966 when he's playing electrical music and, or, you know, electric blues, essentially, in England. He gets booed when he converts to Christianity in the early 80s, and people just want him to be a rock star. He doesn't really get booed anymore, but those albums that he recently released with crooning classics from the 1940s, I mean, if people still booed him, they'd probably be booing him for that. And it's a guy, he just can't, he's never going to settle into being one thing. And of course, if you've got fans, that tends to upset your fans because you're no longer the person they thought you were when you've journeyed into another kind of music or another expression of faith or ideas.
And I think it's Ira Wells who writes one of the essays in the books who touches on this idea of intellectual curiosity, or sorry, intellectual credibility, that he says no matter what it is, that whatever aspect of music, of culture that Dylan is exploring, there's always a real credibility there. Was that a new thing, do you think? I think Ira Wells argues that this was something quite new at that time in the 60s.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true, that Dylan sort of entered with his songwriting at a moment when rock and roll was sort of fading, those teenage songs about falling in love and falling out of love, right? I mean, even that's what the Beatles brought to America with them. Dylan was saying, I can take those same sounds, those same kinds of very simple words and make all kinds of new, much more complex expressions with them. And I'll tell you this, because the Dylan Archive is located here, and that's, you know, 100,000 objects from the length of Dylan's career, you can see that that intellectual credibility is real. Dylan writes and researches and revises and cuts more than he adds and tosses aside thousands of, maybe 1,000 songs for every song he releases. It's an astonishing amount of work that goes into a Dylan song. So there is intellectual credibility there.
Yeah, and you have had access to that Dylan archive. The book that I'm speaking about, The World of Bob Dylan, which is, as I said, a series of 27 different essays on various aspects of Dylan and his creative life, and indeed his personal life as well. What has that archive, what is it opening up now in terms of Dylan studies? And I think the Institute for Bob Dylan Studies in the University of Tulsa is a relatively new institution. So what has the access to the archive opened up for you there?
I mean, I think essentially what it allows you to do is go into the workshop of Daedalus. So, you know, as far as we know, when Dylan songs release, we just think of Dylan as a romantic poet. These things sprung Athena-like from his forehead, fully formed, right? And fans, of course, latch onto them or hate them or whatever. But you don't really know much about how the songs get made, their context, what Dylan was reading at the time or listening to at the time. And I can tell you that in the archive, what you find are not just drafts and drafts and drafts of songs, but notebooks that Dylan's keeping where he's writing down songs he wants to listen to or where he's experimenting with different kinds of songs. He's also keeping shopping lists and measurements for new curtains and all that kind of stuff in these notebooks as well. But you see him working and reading and researching and writing down phrases from the Bible and other sources that he finds interesting. So what the archive lets us do is actually go in and see, how did he make these songs? How did they grow, you know, from an idea jotted down on a page one summer's day in 1966 to a masterpiece, you know, like Blind Willie McTell.
Yeah. You mentioned there are things like curtains and shopping lists. It's hard to think of Bob Dylan as, you know, Bob Dylan is a guy as well who has to get up in the morning and have his breakfast and do the things that all of us do. How private has he kept that personal side, or that, you know, I suppose his own individuality, how private has he kept that, or how open has he been with that aspect of his life?
I mean, I think Dylan's always been a private guy, and he deserves his privacy. He's got a life and family and kids and all that kind of stuff. And there's certainly plenty of personal material in the archive. Some of it embargoed. We won't see it until after he dies, or maybe until the people that are mentioned have died. But it is great to look at the notebooks, as you said, and get that sense of, I mean, one of my favorite little lists he has is like a little to-do list that includes buying groceries and stuff. And the last item on it is renew driver's license. And it's not checked off, which I suspect means Dylan was driving around Woodstock with an invalid driver's license.
Exactly the sort of thing would have been going on in Woodstock, I'm sure, at the time. Driver's licenses weren't at the top of the list of must-dos. Slow Train from 1979. How would you lead us into this, Sean?
I mean, this is Dylan wrestling with another aspect of black music. And this is the album that announces Dylan's conversion to Christianity, a moment which upset lots and lots of his fans at the time. But if we've spent so much of the time here talking about Dylan's relationship to the blues and about a music that's about black suffering, Dylan in these albums, these Christian albums, discovers the other part of black music, which is about community, about uplift, about hope. And I think that's how we can hear these kinds of songs, is reconnecting to that notion of maybe black America carrying the American dream of optimism and freedom in the face of the most terrible kind of suffering. And so it's not mulling over suffering, but rather trying to find some sense of community and hope on the other side of that suffering.
Are they lost or are they found? Have they counted the cost it takes to bring down all the earthly principles? They're gonna have to abandon. And there's a slow train coming. I'll be round.
Slow Train, which first appeared on Bob Dylan's 1979 album of Slow Train Coming. And celebrating the 80th birthday of Bob Dylan with me this evening is Sean Latham, who is the editor of the book The World of Bob Dylan, a series of 27 essays about various aspects of the man's work. And Sean is also the director of the Institute of Bob Dylan Studies at the University of Tulsa. You know, he is an inexhaustible topic, but one of the things that I wanted to talk about, which comes out, is that Robert Shelton, I think, in one of the essays in the book, it talks about the influence of the Beat Generation in particular on Dylan's work. Has that been underestimated, do you think, up to now, Sean, in some ways?
I think probably in some ways. It's the interesting thing about Dylan, and you're sort of saying it now as he's turning 80, it kind of reminds us that Dylan was actually born just before World War II started, at least for the United States. And so Dylan's not really a baby boomer. He may be the voice of the baby boomer generation, but that's because he's a bit older and a bit displaced from that generation. And so they may have wanted him to be their voice, but Dylan's a bit older. And I think that means he's coming from a different kind of set of musical traditions and bringing those into the present as well. And I think that's part of what makes him such an exciting guy to listen to, is that displacement through time.
What about this idea that I think it's Devin Powers writes an essay in the book about the Bob Dylan brand? I'm sure Bob Dylan would balk at the idea that he is a brand or has invented a brand. But Devin argues very strongly that there is a Bob Dylan brand, but he does kind of let him off the hook, I think, as well.
Yeah, and Devin's such an interesting critic, I have to say. We're really fortunate to have her essay for this. She actually was a music critic for The Village Voice for several years before she went to graduate school and got a degree in marketing, and is now a professor of marketing. And so she's able to talk both musically and from a marketing point of view about Dylan's work. I think there's absolutely a Dylan brand. I mean, one of the common jokes, of course, is that everyone has a Bob Dylan impression, because we all kind of know what that voice sounds like. It's just part of the atmosphere in which we live. And how he's used that, how he's built that brand, how he's changed it over the course of career, how he's used it to sell things. It's a fascinating sort of experiment about what pop music does, because for Dylan, it's not just this pure thing that exists on some plane of idealized art. It's always entangled with day-to-day life. You know, for him, it's been selling Victoria's Secret underwear or IBM computers, whatever. But for him, that's we can't really think about music and art separate from the everyday. That's why his music is so important. That's what makes it popular music, is it always remains connected to the vernacular experience. It's not yearning for something beyond the world of everyday life.
But Devin also argues this idea that Dylan in some ways became a brand because brands, whether it's artistic or otherwise, aspired to be like Dylan. So in fact, a reluctant brand is what that sounds like. Is she really, are those the words, without you having to defend her argument, are those the words of such a fan that she can't bear to think that he might just be a brand as well?
Well, I mean, I think it is an interesting exchange. You know, if you want to talk about the history of stardom in the 20th century and thus of brands in the 20th century, Dylan and the Beatles are sort of really interesting groups to pair together to see how they each tried to brand certain kinds of experiences. And the Dylan and the Beatles were always sort of friendly and in competition with one another. Dylan always pulling the Beatles toward being more serious, I think. The Beatles pulling Dylan toward, a sort of fun and lighthearted kind of music.
It's a long way from Hibbing, Minnesota to Stockholm and the Nobel Prize. what was your take on his winning the Nobel Prize for Literature? Because obviously there was such controversy about it at the time.
Well, I think there's no question that he deserves it. And he deserves it because if one of the things the Nobel tries to measure is the effect of an artist on literary culture of all kinds, I think you can make a pretty easy argument, and it's not just me making this argument, Katsuo Ishiguro, another Nobel laureate, made it, Salman Rushdie, another Nobel laureate, made it, that Dylan changed what artists understood they could do with language. That in Dylan's very simple lyrics, his very simple use of words, and his ability to put complex ideas into them, as I said, to insist on the importance of popular culture in the everyday, that's what helped make Salman Rushdie a great writer. It's what helped make Katsuo Ishiguro a great writer. And I'll put on my other hat here and say, you know, the reason I'm in Tulsa, actually, and the other part of my job is I'm the editor of the James Joyce Quarterly. I've devoted much of my career to James Joyce. And I can tell you that Joyce and Dylan are very similar kinds of characters. They both have that same love of the everyday, of popular culture. They both love to cut and paste stuff together to make new art. And I think, you know, Joyce died before he could win the Nobel Prize. So I suppose I'm happy Dylan could get it while he's still alive, because these two guys, probably more than anyone else, speak to the first and second half of the 20th century as being singularly influential figures.
And if you think about James Joyce, you also have to think about music and song very quickly into talking about him, don't you?
Yeah. I mean, Joyce wanted to be a singer, you know, said he threw his second place medal in the Liffey, did not, but said he did. And, you know, Dylan's always kind of wanted to be seen as a writer as well as a performer. Dylan's also a painter, a filmmaker. So I think both of them had these kind of restless interests in other art forms as well. And that's part of what makes them interesting and an interesting pairing as well.
All right, Sean, you get, it's not your birthday, but you're getting a Bob Dylan birthday present, which is, we said we'd finish up by having you choose, I think what probably is a personal favorite in terms of Dylan music, but also a song that you think contains an awful lot of what Dylan is and portrays.
Yeah, this is a terrific song. Hard Rain's Gonna Fall. It's one of Dylan's earliest songs in which a young man sort of goes out in the world, has terrible experiences, and comes back and reports them to his mother, but ends by saying, "I'll learn my song well. I'm gonna go back out and do it again." And Patti Smith performs a cover of this song at the Nobel Awards and even bobbles a verse, and it's almost like she's saying back to Dylan, you know, through all those years, you did it. You lived through all those hard rains. You did learn your song well, and you've given it to us. That's the real gift, I think, that I'm happy to celebrate on Dylan's birthday.
All right. Well, Sean Latham, thank you so much for being with us today. I'm sure you have a very busy Bob Dylan birthday day to do today. So enjoy the rest of it. And here for you is Hard Rains Are Gonna Fall.
Oh, where have you been, my blue-eyed son? And where have you been, my darling young one? I've stumbled on the side of 12 misty mountains. I've walked and I crawled on 6 crooked highways. I've stepped in the middle of 7 sad forests.
You're listening to Monday Night Arena. Well, we're not the only ones marking Bob Dylan's 80th birthday, as indeed you may have gathered just from listening to the radio today. And when this show is over from 8 p.m. this evening, a special live event kicks off at the US Ambassador's Residence in the Phoenix Park, where musicians and artists will gather to celebrate the work of Bob Dylan. Curated by Other Voices and the US Embassy Dublin's Creative Minds, Dignity is an evening of songs, poetry and collaborations in honour of Bob Dylan's music and social impact. We'll stream live from the US Ambassador's Residence in Dublin's Phoenix Park, 8 p.m. this evening. You can watch the event live on rte.ie/culture or on Other Voices, YouTube and Facebook platforms. Artists taking part include Lisa Hannigan, Felly Speaks, Joseph O'Connor and Mick Flannery, who joins me on the line right now. Two songs you're going to perform this evening. First of all, Mick, let's have a talk about both of them and what they mean to you. You'll be duetting Oh Sister with Susan O'Neill, in fact, this evening. That was on the 1976 album Desire. What is it about this song that particularly appeals to you?
It was a sing-along song at the kind of get-togethers for our family. Myself and my mother used to sing this song, and my aunt, amongst other from that album too, One More Cup of Coffee, we used to do that too. It's been something I've played at kind of sing-alongs for since I was about 16 or 17.
And would you have been listening to Dylan, you know, apart from the fact that that song was part of family sing-alongs, would you have been listening to him as a teenager?
Yeah, the first batch of albums I bought was Nirvana Unplugged, and Bob Dylan Bringing It All Back Home. And then I bought the Best of the Eagles as well, but that was taken off me by a guy. My dad brought me into a pub in Cork, and I had just done my CD shopping. And there's a musician in Cork, Ricky Lynch is his name, and he was in the bar. And he confiscated the Eagles CD. He said, you can listen to the other two, but not this one.
So this was because you were being censored. Your listening was being censored at that point. Rick reckoned, no listening to the Eagles.
He said he thought my education would be curtailed by listening to the Best of the Eagles.
Yeah.
So he made an executive decision.
Well, perhaps he thought your music education would be broadened by listening to Bob Dylan and by perhaps being sent off to buy further Bob Dylan albums afterwards. How important would you say his music is and was to you, particularly starting out then, Mick, in your teenage years, in how you progressed as a singer-songwriter yourself?
My dad used to say a thing called, or the phrase, I don't know, it's called, only listen to the masters. I don't know who said that, or it probably applies to lots of different vocations. That's what he used to say about Dylan and Waits. And I listened to Bob Dylan a lot, you know, starting to write songs, and it gives you a high bar.
It certainly does.
And I really felt Bob Dylan songs, those were what songs really are. They can be played, you know, just with the guitar on their own, and they tell a story, and they kind of, they keep the listener interested.
And one thing that strikes me, you know, a similarity in the way you write yourself, Mick, is you're never afraid in terms of the lyrical content of a song to allow it to be just that, to be lyrical, to be poetic in the nature that Dylan does as well. It's not often always easy to fathom the content of a Dylan lyric. You're not afraid to let that kind of poeticism feed into your own writing, I think.
I mean, that's the type of song I like, I guess. I put a lot of weight into the lyrics. I guess I just like them to be good, to make sense. And Dylan had a way, like a brilliant way of writing, and multifaceted as well, you know. Some of it could be humorous, some of it could be very kind of conversational. He had a whole repertoire of kind of prose about him.
Yeah, and when you say making sense, it didn't have to make, you know, simple narrative sense. It could be a much more intangible type of thing that you mightn't even be able to explain other than in the lyric itself.
Yeah, he had a way of writing songs that sounded like they came from other worlds, like Shelter from the Storm and Tangled Up in Blue. But he was able to pull it off. I mean, you just immediately agreed that this other world exists and this is what happens there. That's so good was he at creating the atmosphere of it.
And that didn't come, it didn't just fall off his pen onto the page. You were talking earlier about this idea that how hard he worked at revising and reworking lyrics. Do you find yourself doing the same type of thing, Mick? You know, that it's not just, oh, there's the lyric, it came into my head, I wrote it down and then I made up a song.
Throwaway lyrics bother me. I get bothered by hearing songs on the radio where I feel it's a good song and the melody is strong, and then I hear some cheesy line in it that I think, my God, why did they ruin this song with not improving that line? It bothers me. Like, I don't know, like something out of place. I have kind of pernickety standards when it comes to the words of songs, all right?
Well, you can thank your father for telling you to listen to the masters. That's why you have pernickety standards when it comes to writing songs. You said that you'll be duetting with Susan O'Neill, as I said, on Oh Sister. The other song that you're performing tonight is It's All Right Ma. And this comes from Bringing It All Back Home, that first album that you bought in your tranche of three, of which you were allowed to keep two. this is a song that there's not a spare lyric in it, and boy, are they quotable.
Yeah, I remember before I bought it, a man quoting it to me in a bar. He had the line, "He not busy being born is busy dying." And that is a striking line. And Dylan has it in the second verse of a 12-verse song. Usually, like, songwriters keep that type of gold for the end and they finish on it. But he had it gone by the second verse because he had plenty more to say after that. I mean, it's an amazing song, like...
Yeah, because that, I suppose, He Not Busy Being Born is Busy Dying is a kind of an existential side to it. But there are quite strong political and social content there's quite strong political and social content in the song as well. Money doesn't talk, it swears. Yeah. He was quite down on the commercialism, and you and you've been saying if you have throwaway lyrics, he'd have been right down on that as well. That's what he was picking at it here in some ways, that commercial aspect of things.
Yeah, the flesh-coloured Christ that glow in the dark, it's easy to see without looking too far, not much is really sacred. He was picking holes in kind of obvious kind of hypocrisies and, you know, the flaws of society. He could see them all. He could see the flaws in certain different people that would point out flaws in society as well. It seems to encapsulate all points of views. The one who sings with his tongue on fire cares not to come up any higher.
Yeah.
When I was young, I couldn't hardly fathom how good it was, you know, or how educational it was. You know, people don't really speak in that way when they talk to you. You know, it would take a long time to have all those conversations that he has kind of reduced into verse for that song.
Well, listen, Mick, great to speak with you this evening. I'm sure you're delighted to be back performing live tonight. It's the first time in a long time that many of you are getting to do that. Enjoy the gig. And we'll finish
Thank
up
you.
By listening to Dylan himself with It's All Right Ma, brackets, I'm Only Bleeding. Thanks, Mick.
Thank you very much.
Darkness at the break of noon, shadows even the silver spoon, the handmade blade, the child's balloon, eclipses both the sun and moon, to understand you know too soon, there's no sense in trying. Pointed threats they bluff with scorn, suicide remarks are torn from the fool's gold mouthpiece, the hollow horn plays wasted words, proves to warn that he not busy being born is busy dying.
It's a great lyric, isn't it? He not busy being born, he's busy dying. That's from It's All Right But Ma, I'm Only Bleeding, which is one of the songs that Mick Fanner will be performing this evening in the American Embassy residence. And in fact, Bob Dylan and Chris First, who's the acting deputy chief of mission at the American Embassy, have something in common. They're both from Minnesota, so it's hardly surprising that Chris First was instrumental in the organisation of Dignity, the special live stream celebration of the work of Bob Dylan that's taking place this evening. It's coming live, as we've been saying, from the US Embassy residence in the Phoenix Park. It's hosted by LOA, starring other voices performers, Lisa Hannigan, Amelia Baker of Cinderwell, Peter Broderick, Bridget May Power, Paul Brady, Mick Flannery, to whom we were just speaking, and others. Now, Kay Sheehy went out to the US Ambassador's residence this afternoon to listen in on the sound checks and the rehearsals.
Thank you. Broderick and Bridget May Power.
Yeah.
What are you singing tonight?
Well, we're singing One More Cup of Coffee. It's off the album Desire. And yeah, we both just really love that album. And I, funnily enough, recorded that song a few months ago. So I just thought that would be the best option.
Yes, and my parents used to listen to that album when I was a child. So I was just talking to Philip King there. He asked me when was the first time I heard Bob Dylan, and I think it was that album. So it's a song that's been with me for a long time as well.
What is it about that song that speaks to you?
Well, for me personally, there's a musical element of that whole album has a fiddle player on it. The fiddle's just gorgeous, and the fiddle's my instrument. So that's one thing that always drew me to it. And I think there's something very nostalgic thinking about just having a cup of coffee. You know, like you mention a cup of coffee and it puts you in a certain headspace.
I just think that whole album and that song is really mysterious. It's got this kind of mystical vibe to it, and it's kind of got Eastern sounds. Straight, your hair is smooth on the pillow where you lie. But I don't sense affection, no gratitude or love. Your loyalty is not for me, but to the stars above. One more cup of coffee for the road. One more cup of coffee before I go to the valley below.
Christopher Worst, Acting Deputy Chief of Mission. This is your brainchild.
Yeah, I guess you could say that. I'm from Minnesota, and Bob Dylan is, of course, from Minnesota. And so, but he's an iconic American artist that is recognized all over the United States and all over the world, of course. So we wanted to do something cultural and celebrate him for his 80th birthday. Here in Ireland, it was an embarrassment of wealth when in terms of the amazing musicians you have here. And you know, it's so gratifying to know that so many people kind of jumped at the opportunity to perform a Dylan song for his birthday. But for the embassy, it's really gratifying because it's been a long time since we've been able to do an event from Deerfield House here in Phoenix Park. For us, this is really kind of a comeback program, and so excited to be able to do it with other voices as well.
And what do you think Bob would think of this? You know, he's so anti-establishment.
Yeah. You know, the beauty of Bob is that he probably wouldn't care. There's a great story when President Obama gave him the Presidential Medal of Freedom. And he said that Dylan just came in with sunglasses on. He knocked out the song, put his sunglasses back on, and just left. Didn't stick around for photos, didn't sign autographs. And President Obama said, you know, that's just exactly how you want Bob Dylan. You know, he is his own person. He's his own man. And he's not, you know, he doesn't bend to the whim of popular culture or trends. He is true to himself. And I think people around the world respond positively to that.
Does he know what you're up to?
He probably doesn't. You know, I have to say, though, that the fact that we have Paul Brady, for instance, you know, this isn't a case where Paul Brady is doing a Dylan song. This is a case where you have an Irish musician who has given three songs to Bob Dylan. So maybe given the names that we have here in Ireland, Bob may be paying attention to this.
So Amelia, yes. Baker, you're playing tonight. You're playing with two other musicians.
So I'm playing with Jim Getty and Brian McGlynn of Ye Vagabonds. We decided to do Restless Farewell, which is actually based on The Parting Glass, which we think he got from Liam Clancy. It's a nice kind of full circle Irish-American traditional folk song.
And you're from California. Did Bob Dylan mean a lot in your youth growing up?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I grew up, like, my family was obsessed with Bob Dylan and he was always playing in the house. So it wasn't even something that I came to on my own, in a sense. It was just, like, kind of part of the landscape. But doing this event has been such a wonderful opportunity to dig into his work.
Be it mine, right or wrongfully, I let it slip gladly to my friends to tie up the time most forcefully. But the bottles are done, we've killed each one, and the table is full, and overflows. And the corner sign says it's closing time, so I'll bid farewell and be down the road.
Janine Curran, you're the floor manager here at the Other Voices event, but you have a personal connection to Bob Dylan.
I do indeed. Like, my family had a hotel in Maynooth, a country house hotel, where Bob Dylan stayed for, I think it was maybe 6 to 8 weeks in about 92, 93. I remember coming home from school and saying to my dad, who's the strange man walking around? But he loved it there, and he used to walk down to the town and go for a pint in the LA, and no one ever bothered him. And it was lovely. And it's funny, it's my dad's anniversary today. So, and Dad loved Bob Dylan, so it all comes into place sometimes, you know.
And did he ever perform there?
No, he was by himself. It was basically a retreat for himself to be away from everybody and everything.
Since my heart now fails, point away from the past, I'll bid farewell and be down the line.
Amelia Baker there, and Cinderwell, one of the many performers at Dignity to celebrate Bob Dylan's 80th birthday. It will be live streamed tonight from the US Ambassador to Residence in the Phoenix Park at 8 p.m. and you'll find it on the Other Voices YouTube and Facebook platforms, and also on rte.ie/culture. 9 minutes to 8 on the 24th of May, 2021, the 80th birthday of Bob Dylan, and the celebration here continues on Lyric Arena. In the 1960s, the New York neighbourhood of Greenwich Village was at the heart of America's folk music revival, attracted aspiring young musicians from all over, including the future Nobel laureate, who had just begun to call himself Bob Dylan. Shortly after arriving from Minnesota, Dylan met, followed and studied the Clancy brothers, who had a few years previously left Carrick on Shore in County Tipperary and moved to New York. Liam Clancy described Dylan as a restless, fidgeting kid who seemed to show up everywhere the band were playing. Dylan later acknowledged his debt to the Clancys and the influence that they had on him. Joining me now is John Marr. Tell us a little bit more about the Clancy brothers and their influence on Bob Dylan. John, we heard a little touch of it there in some of those performing at the embassy, in fact, this evening, talking about the effect that the Clancy brothers, are the influence that they had on him. But where were they, first of all? What had they, or how had they established themselves in New York when Dylan arrived there from Minnesota?
Yeah, they were very well established by the time he arrives in 60-61. They'd made the journey across the Atlantic in the 50s and tried their hand on Broadway, and they'd released two albums right up to 61, when he first encountered them in a legendary pub in Greenwich Village called the White Horse Tavern. This was a place, Sean, that was frequented by people like Dylan Thomas, Norman Mailer, Hunter S. Thompson. So you can imagine the kind of boozing that would have happened. And Dylan just saw them one night, and as you alluded to there, as Liam Clancy had said, just followed them around. Basically was just awestruck by them. In fact, in the 1984 documentary, The Story of the Clancy Brothers and Tommy Makem, Dylan says,
"Well, actually, do you know what? Don't,
yep, good as
don't tell me what he says, because I have him saying it. I have him saying it right here. Let's listen to Bob Dylan in that 1984 documentary, as you say, John Marr, talking about the Clancy Brothers and Liam in particular as a singer.
Well, I'd never heard those kind of songs before, although I close up, you know, I'd heard them on records. but I hadn't heard them close up. All the legendary people they used to sing about, the Brennan on the Moor or Roddy McCorley or these people, I wasn't aware of them when they existed, but it was as if they just existed yesterday. You were around them all the time, and they just sang so many songs all the time. You just you couldn't help. But the first album I made, there was one song on it that it was an old song from I'd heard on an old banjo record someplace. But I did that song the way the Clancy Brothers I thought would have done it. You know, if you know, in their style. For me, I never heard a singer as good as Liam ever. He was just the best ballad singer I'd ever heard in my life. And still is, probably. I don't think I can think of anybody who's a better ballad singer than Liam.
Bob Dylan there from the 1984 documentary about the Clancy Brothers. And I think, John Maher, that's probably the quote you were going to give me, that what he says at the very end about Liam Clancy there and the quality of his ballad singing. And you get from that clip, John, the idea that it was both the way, the songs themselves, but particularly the way the Clancy Brothers delivered them.
Absolutely. And there's another quote, and I hope you don't have this one, where and this really captures what Dylan saw in them. And he said, "What I heard in the Clancy Brothers were rousing rebel songs that were Napoleonic in scope, and they were just these musketeer-type characters. But then, on the other level, they had the romantic ballads that would just slay you in your tracks, the sweetness of Tommy Makem and Liam. It was like a sword that would take off your head." And that fascination with them continued right up to the present day. I mean, chronicles his autobiography from 2004. He's writing about that time again, just this sense about what the White Horse Tavern had been to him as a young green character straight from Minnesota in the big city. And remember, 1961, the year all this happens, was the year that the Clancy Brothers appear on the Ed Sullivan Show, brandish wearing those Aran jumpers that Mrs. Clancy and South Tipperary had sent over because the winter before had been so punishingly cold, and that became their trademark. And we sometimes forget today just how enormous the Clancy Brothers were. I mean, Gay Byrne on the Late Late Show said, The most famous four Irish men on the planet, and they were hugely influential for young Dylan.
Well, let's listen to, this is a direct example of the type of influence they had. First thing that you're going to hear is the Clancy Brothers with the song Brennan on the Moor.
And a story we will tell. His name was Willie Brennan, and in Ireland he did dwell. 'Twas on the Kilworth Mountains he commenced his wild career, and many a wealthy nobleman before him shook with fear. And it's Brennan on the Moor.
Okay, that's the Clancy Brothers and Brennan on the Moor. Now, there's no distance between that and this, I think we'll all agree.
Come around, you roving gamblers, and a story I will tell about the greatest gambler y'all should know well. His name was Willie O'Connelly, and he gambled all his life. He's had 27 children, yet he's never had a wife. And it's right, Willie, right.
There's no doubt that Willie O'Connelly and Brennan on the Moor were cousins of some kind or other, certainly musical cousins. It's phenomenal, the parallels that are there, John Maher.
No, absolutely. And for those that don't know, Willie Brennan was a real-life highwayman from Cork who was hanged in about 1804, a notorious figure. I think what Dylan did there was just embellished a song. I think he loved the rousing balladry of the Clancys, but also I suppose their ability to tell stories. And as some of your other guests on this show have suggested, Dylan is such a brilliant storyteller, and he can capture those in 4 or 5 minute songs.
The other thing is that the Clancys were partially responsible for Dylan's deal with Columbia Records, weren't they? They were involved in that?
Yeah, they were. Tom Clancy in particular, he had been asked by a Columbia Records executive, "Do you know somebody who's good on harmonica? And he said, "Yeah, I do. This young guy called Zimmerman. He calls himself Dylan now. He is he's handy on the harmonica." So, of course, Dylan would go on to have this legendary partnership or association with Columbia.
Yeah, and the friendship between Dylan and especially Liam Clancy continued right through their lives until Liam's passing in 2009. But you see other Irish musicians who have influenced Dylan in some way. We heard in the package there from the embassy about Paul Brady in particular.
Yeah, Paul Brady helped the Lakes of Pontartrain, which of course Paul Brady had done a beautiful version of in the late 70s. And he tells a great story about actually meeting Dylan. Dylan wants to know, how did you play that particular thing on guitar? And Brady talks about arranging Dylan's fingers on the fretboard. Later on in the 80s, it's Bono who has had a very fruitful working relationship with Daniel Lanois, and he recommends Lanois to Dylan, and Lanois goes on to produce Oh Mercy, released in 1989, considered by many to be a comeback for Dylan after a sort of an up and down 80s. And I suppose to even more recently, if you look at Rough and Rowdy Ways, I mean, his most recent album, he talks about Balnalee, a tiny little village in County Longford. And it's suggested that this is from an O'Rafferty poem from centuries ago, but the idea might have been planted in his head by Shane McGowan. Apparently they had a boozy night together in the Intercontinental Hotel in Ballsbridge some years ago.
There you go. Well, listen, let's hope that whatever he's given then, that claim that was made, that perhaps Dylan might have an interest in Irish celebrations of his birthday, and that he might just be listening into some of those celebrations. We'll definitely wish him a happy birthday from all in RTE and all here on